You're listening to a news report podcast from thebodypro.com, the HIV resource for healthcare professionals.
Hello, and welcome to HIV Management Today, a new clinical management series from thebodypro.com. I'm Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of thebodypro.com. This first discussion in the series is entitled New Paradigms of First-Line HIV Therapy, Determining When and With What to Start. In this very nuanced discussion, you'll come away with a deeper understanding of the shifting paradigms of first-line HIV therapy today. Joining us are two of the top HIV clinician researchers in the United States. Dr. Eric Darr is chief of HIV medicine at Harbor UCLA Medical Center in Los Angeles, California. He's also a professor of medicine at the UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine. Also joining us is Dr. Trevor Hawkins, founder and medical director of Southwest Care Center in Santa Fe. He's also associate clinical professor at the University of New Mexico. Welcome, Dr. Darr and Dr. Hawkins. During the past year or so, there have been a flurry of new studies that have called into question, when is the optimal time to initiate antiretroviral therapy? Dr. Darr, can you share with us your thoughts?
Well, I think this continues to be an area for which there's been a lot of discussion and almost controversy because of the limited data to answer the specific question. And clinicians would like to have a randomized controlled trial to definitively address this issue, and we've never had that. So we've relied heavily upon cohort data, recognizing all the limitations of it. And as a result of the cohort data, the bar has shifted. And what we've always incorporated along with the data supporting potentially a role for earlier therapy translating into some better outcomes is the cost of therapy, and particularly not dollars, but the toxicity and the risk of selecting for resistance. And I think what we've seen over the last several years is more and more cohort data supporting earlier therapy. We now have a randomized controlled trial from Haiti that actually demonstrated that people who started therapy between 200 and 350 T cells did better than those who started at less than 200. We have two cohorts that have demonstrated potentially better outcomes amongst those who start therapy between 350 and 450 or 500, and one cohort that even shows better outcomes amongst those who started with CD4s greater than 500 versus less than 500. And the cohorts alone probably wouldn't be sufficient to drive dramatic changes in practice, but it's coming along with the fact that we have so many treatment options that are currently very well tolerated with extremely high levels of efficacy, relatively low levels of toxicity, resistance, and many other options. So even if resistance were to develop, we'd still be able to successfully treat patients. So we put the small one randomized controlled trial, several cohort studies, dramatic changes in the types of therapies that are available for our patients, and then build on top of that sort of one other major observation that has come out over the last several years, and this relationship between ongoing viremia and high levels of activation and inflammation and how this might affect other end organs other than things like the immune system, such as endothelial function, which can have an impact on cardiovascular disease and renal. And with all of this, there's an increasing case being built, even in the absence of a large randomized controlled trial, for perhaps recommending therapy to virtually everybody who, importantly, are ready, willing, and able to commit to treatment.
Dr. Hawkins, do you agree or disagree?
I do agree. I agree with Eric, particularly in the sense that if it were just the cohort studies, and because cohort studies have inbuilt potential bias, both lead time bias and confounding issues that can affect which groups do what, then I think we would be more nervous. But there's such a body of evidence that replicating virus is just not a good thing. In almost any infection, particularly one as widespread as HIV, which affects so many different body compartments, as Eric said, we clearly have evidence that this leads to high levels of immune activation, and you can measure that by measuring immune activation markers. This, in turn, drives inflammation, and inflammation is a big buzzword these days. It clearly affects organs, it affects blood vessels, it affects endothelial function. We have a lot of data, too, on CD4 counts and how important they are. A lot of cohorts have suggested that non-AIDS events non-AIDS malignancies, cardiovascular disease, renal disease, liver disease, are related to nadir CD4 count. A study from France, from Charlotte Leyden, looked at 2,300 patients from the boosted PI era in a couple of French hospital cohorts, and along with a well-matched HIV-negative cohort. And although the mortality rate was seven times higher in the HIV cohort, those patients who reached a CD4 count of 500 and above had the same mortality rate as the HIV-negative cohort. So not definitive, but more grist to the mill. So there's this growing sense that HIV replication, if left unchecked, is just not a good thing. And one thing we haven't mentioned was neurocognitive function. And some recent data this year from the CHARTER cohort suggesting that neurocognitive function is significantly impaired in up to half of that particular cohort, and that function was directly correlated with nadir CD4. There's this growing body of evidence that I think a lot of us, certainly, and I'm one of them, believe that it's sufficient to offer treatment to anybody, again, as Eric said, and very importantly, when patients are ready to start therapy. One further point I would make is that, of course, I know in my neck of the woods in New Mexico, 60% of newly diagnosed patients here have a concurrent diagnosis of AIDS, so they're presenting late. So to some extent, you could argue that the argument around the data is somewhat academic, although it's still important. However, I think if widespread opt-out testing becomes more accepted, and we have data from D.C. that suggests that as opt-out testing is made more available, the CD4 count at the time of diagnosis does in fact go up. Theirs went from around 200 in 2002 up to around 300 in 2007, largely linked, we think, to newer testing. So I do think this will become more and more, this argument on this issue will become more and more relevant.
I agree with Trevor. I think that there are a lot of other issues that we need to sort out, but may be very important. And this question about when to start and the neurocognitive issues are extremely important, and I agree there are several studies that seem to suggest that it is the CD4 nadir, or how advanced someone's disease was, that defines the level of neurocognitive dysfunction more than their current CD4 or viral load. So there may be ongoing neurologic damage, almost certainly is, during the course of disease that may be only partially or maybe not at all reversible. I think other comorbidities are also important to consider. If one does decides after discussion with the patient that they're not going to assume that there are sufficient reasons to start everybody on therapy, recognizing that people with relatively high T cells probably have a relatively low absolute risk of things like death and progression to clinical AIDS, at the very least, serious consideration of other comorbid conditions might influence the decision. And we know that ongoing viral replication may predispose people to things like renal, liver, and cardiovascular disease, those who have underlying organ dysfunction for any one of a number of reasons in these areas might use that as an additional excuse to consider starting therapy earlier than they might have otherwise. And I think both the U.S. and European guidelines have increasingly, over the last several years, taken these comorbid conditions into consideration and suggested they be part of the discussion with an individual patient about when therapy should be optimally started.
Yeah, I know hepatitis B is clearly indicated in our guidelines. Hep C, I think, is mentioned in the European guidelines. It'd be interesting to see if the new guidelines, which are due fairly soon, will mention hepatitis C, because clearly HIV accelerates the progression of hepatitis C where that's a comorbidity. Might also mention bone disease, which seems to be more common, so osteopenia and osteoporosis, more common in patients with HIV disease. And then I think one thing we haven't mentioned, but clearly is important, is the very strong data that suggests that an undetectable viral load very significantly diminishes the risk of transmission. And since the CDC estimate that half of all new infections are derived from people who don't know they're HIV positive, to test those people and treat them will hopefully reduce the incidence rate.
We now consider that as another thing to talk to our patients about in situations where they're concerned about potentially transmitting to a partner, such as those in a stable relationship with a discordant partner, we certainly don't suggest they shouldn't be using condoms and other means to prevent transmission, but it's reasonable to explain to them that there is at least inferential data, and hopefully soon will be randomized controlled trial data, showing that being on therapy may reduce the risk of transmission in the event of things like a broken condom.
So let's turn now to the challenge of selecting a regimen. How do expert doctors choose a regimen? Can you walk us through your thinking, Dr. Dar?
So we have lots of great choices, and we have large randomized controlled trials with now, for virtually all of our primary options, at least 2 years of follow-up that demonstrate their overall safety and efficacy. And I think in the past and even today, the standard regimens have usually included two nucleosides with either a protease inhibitor or an NNRTI. And based upon tolerability and the efficacy data, we now have a variety of choices amongst the protease inhibitors, including many once-a-day protease inhibitors that will create once-a-day regimens with fixed-dose combination nucleosides. In the current DHHS guidelines, the preferred PIs have been darunavir, fosaprenavir with ritonavir twice daily, lopinavir-ritonavir once or twice daily, and atazanavir-ritonavir is a popular once-a-day regimen is preferred. So we have these four PI-based regimens and a variety of alternative regimens, which are also quite effective. And then from the NNRTI perspective, the preferred option has been efavirenz, primarily because I think of the overwhelming efficacy data and tolerability with nevirapine as an alternative. And I think it's reasonable to understand that there are some differences between these regimens. Simple, obvious ones to our patients are the pill burden. Efavirenz can be part of a fixed-dose combination with one pill once a day, which is very appealing and has been shown to be highly efficacious, but has unique neurologic side effects that we don't see with the other drugs that patients need to be aware of, and if they occur, need to understand that they'll usually get better, but if not, certainly a switch can happen. And there are issues for women of childbearing potential because it is a Category D drug in pregnancy. So, and certainly women who are pregnant or women who might become pregnant, we'd need to take that in mind. And in addition to the unique side effects and issues surrounding pregnancy, the other unique factor with NNRTIs versus PIs is the risk of developing resistant virus if virologic failure should occur. And certainly with efavirenz, when people experience virologic failure, albeit quite rare if they take their drugs consistently, but when it happens, resistance is a likelihood. In contrast with the boosted PIs, many of them are once a day, and they range in pill count from 3 with atazanavir, ritonavir with the nucleosides versus a 4 or 5 with some of the other PIs. So it's a little bit more in the way of pills. The side effects aren't neurologic. They are generally more gastrointestinal. All of these drugs can be associated with some dyslipidemia, as can the NNRTIs. So the trade-off, I think, is different toxicities, different pill count, but the resistance part is also really compelling in that when you use a boosted PI, if things don't go right, the likelihood of developing primary protease mutations is extraordinarily low. So to me, those are the major trade-offs between the first-line regimens we choose. I would share those with any given patient, and based upon that, allow them to be a part of the decision as to what they do next. Certainly in those patients where I'm particularly concerned about their ability to adhere consistently with therapy or come back for follow-up visits consistently, I may be more inclined to push them towards a boosted PI, because if they do disappear or stop taking their meds for any one of a number of reasons, the likelihood of selecting for resistance is smaller. But again, that's part of the individualization. Then the last one that I think is worth mentioning, and it's not currently listed as a preferred option, but it has an FDA indication now, is the first-in-class integrase inhibitor raltegravir, which is given twice a day. So it's nucleoside combination with raltegravir, one pill twice a day, makes it a little bit different. And we now have 2 years of follow-up from the pivotal naive trial showing that it was as efficacious as efavirenz, probably better tolerated, certainly from a lipid perspective. It seems to be associated with limited side effects, at least with the amount of follow-up available. But like efavirenz, if virologic failure occurs, which was quite rare, resistance to the integrase inhibitor happens. So it's a new drug in a new class that can be used first line and has an indication to be used in that way. recognizing that there is somewhat less data. So those are the kinds of things that I walk through with patients and thinking about the variety of first-line options. And then I always tell them, though, the most important thing is that whatever we do, we need to continue to interact, and that if you're having any problems taking the therapy for any reasons, whether it's toxicity, dosing schedule, or other factors, social factors like homelessness, disclosure issues, substance or alcohol abuse, that they just need to let me know or let their provider know so that we can make adjustments as necessary.
Dr. Hawkins?
Eric has done a good job of reviewing the current choices. I think what really drives the choice these days is tolerability. A couple of old ideas have gone by the wayside. One was that if you had a patient presenting with a low CD4 and a high viral load, you should use a boosted PI. And we've seen that Efavirenz has done as well or better than any challenger in patients with both low CD4 counts and with high viral loads. So that idea that you can't use a non-nuke in patients in those situations is no longer acceptable. And the second thing that we always used to do was keep a PI in your back pocket so you could sequence PI failure. And as Eric said, study after study has shown that boosted PIs in PI-naive patients, when patients have virologic failure, they do not fail with primary PI mutations, and that, I think, has caused a huge shift. So given all of this, and given that the current recommended regimens, they all work pretty well if patients will take them, then the issues of tolerability and adherence really dominate choice. For instance, in the PI class, I think certainly in my practice there's a shift towards using either atazanavir or darunavir as preferred PIs, partly because they're once a day. Fosamprenivir, Kevitra, and lopinavir can be used once a day. However, they seem to be associated with higher rates of GI intolerance. And so diarrhea, for instance, in Castle was lower with atazanavir than with lopinavir. Similarly, in Artemis, it was lower rates of diarrhea with darunavir than with lopinavir. And also better triglycerides, lower triglyceride increases. So these things are, in fact, what really drive choice these days, because we know that the best regimen is the one that your patients will take. If it's more tolerable, if it's fewer pills, then they're likely to take it better. And, of course, there are 101 other issues, such as mental illness, substance abuse. Eric had mentioned homelessness, food, disclosure issues, all these things that are really, really important in determining how well a patient's going to take any regimen. But what we can do in terms of choosing the regimen is choose the regimen that's likely to be best tolerated.
Yeah, and I agree, and it's sort of an interesting phenomenon how things have changed, how we focus so much early on efficacy, and we still do. It's just there are so many efficacious options that it is ultimately tolerability. The challenge for us is that we can't guarantee any one patient how well they'll tolerate a specific regimen. For example, the fixed-dose combination with the Efavirenz is a very popular first-line regimen. We certainly use it frequently in our clinic. And the overwhelming majority of patients, despite warning them of some of the neurologic toxicities, tolerate it great. They have no side effects at all, or they're minimal and they go away, but others, they don't. And same thing with things like boosted atazanavir, extremely well-tolerated regimen. But some people, not very many, but some will develop hyperbilirubinemia and jaundice, and they'll need to switch. So we just need to make sure that they're prepared to work with us regardless of what happens. And the other comment I would make is in along the lines of what Trevor talked about with this issue of sequencing, because I hear this discussed a lot, is historically we thought about sequencing protease inhibitors when we used non-boosted PIs. So, for example, we used nalcinavir first, because it's selected for a unique resistance pattern in which there were a variety of other options. People have sometimes tried to extrapolate that experience to current boosted PIs. For example, saying darunavir-ritonavir is currently approved as a first-line regimen for treatment-naive patients as a once-a-day therapy. But gee, why would I want to use darunavir-ritonavir as my first PI when it was developed as a salvage drug, as we saw in the POWER studies? And if I use it first and they develop resistance, will I then not have other PIs to use? It's a faulty argument, because the experience with all of these boosted PIs is that unless you really don't follow patients at all and allow them to have ongoing viremia for prolonged periods of time, they're not going to select for resistance. The reason they're likely to experience virologic failure is if they don't take the meds consistently, not because of emerging resistant mutations to protease. So again, this focus on the decision needs to be on tolerability and specific unique issues towards the patient.
Are there particular patients that get special attention when crafting a regimen? You mentioned homeless people, but what about patients with kidney problems and heart disease risk, mental health problems?
Clearly, those things are very important, so we can take a few of those and look at them. The preferred nucleoside backbone in the current guidelines is tenofovir and tricitabine, and clearly tenofovir can and does reduce creatinine clearance in most patients a small amount. If patients have normal creatinine clearance and normal kidney function, generally it's that small 8 to 10 milliliters per minute reduction in creatinine clearance is probably not significant. However, if patients have pre-existing renal disease, then it may indeed be significant. It may be a contributing factor to making the kidney disease worse. You can reduce the dose or adjust the dose, and I do that very liberally because I think with its very long intracellular half-life, tenofovir can quite easily be dosed every other day. Nevertheless, if you have patients with pre-existing renal disease, then it may be better to avoid tenofovir and use something else, which is why the debate over abacavir becomes important, because abacavir doesn't have any toxicity to the kidney at all and was clearly a go-to choice for patients with pre-existing renal disease. Now we have some markers that suggest that abacavir may be related to an increased risk of myocardial infarction. Of course, heart disease is the leading cause of death for people with renal disease. So that has confounded the issue a little bit, and we're waiting to try and clarify this issue about abacavir and heart disease. The DAD data and data from Quebec and other data sets, other cohort sets have suggested there is a relationship, and other cohorts have not found that relationship, most recently the VA cohort. And we can discuss those in detail and argue which are the better cohorts and the better studies. But I think the bottom line is, particularly with the lack of an understanding of the pathogenesis of why abacavir would cause an increased risk for myocardial infarction, the debate is still raging, and we don't really know the final answer. And I think it's important that we do, partly because of this renal issue. At the current time, and my practice is to avoid tenofovir in people with renal disease and to avoid abacavir in people with very high risks for heart attack, because I think the data suggests that if there is a risk, then it's in those patients.
Dr. Dar?
I think that those are important issues, and they're difficult for us to deal with, both amongst us clinicians as well as with our patients, because the data is imperfect. I agree with Trevor. We can debate forever how to interpret these cohort studies, but the bottom line is, with at least one very large cohort study, the DAD, there is this signal that's been seen with abacavir and 3TC, and then we have the other data sets that haven't shown it. So we're forced, I think, to share this information with our patients and probably use it in as best we can in clinical practice, much like Trevor suggested. If there's a compelling reason to use abacavir 3TC, such as somebody who's not a great candidate for tenofovir, I would freely use it. I might have a little more angst in doing so in somebody who has multiple cardiovascular risk factors, but even in that setting, ongoing renal failure in the face of a potentially nephrotoxic drug is a cardiovascular risk factor as well. So I think we tend to lean towards tenofovir FTC if all things are equal, because we don't have these concerns. But we need to recognize it's not because we know unequivocally that abacavir 3TC is a problem. We don't. And we know it's a highly efficacious drug that in people who are B5701 negative, which is a prerequisite for using it, since we can define those people as not being at risk for hypersensitivity reaction, that this drug has a long track record as being highly efficacious and very, very well tolerated. So it comes down to sharing all the information with our patients and individualizing based on unique factors for the patients as to which nucleoside we start with, and always be prepared to make changes as we're monitoring people carefully for the development of new toxicities or increasing toxicities, such as someone perhaps who has chronic renal disease. And I think it's worth mentioning that this whole debate based on data from cohort studies is extended beyond nucleosides to also some of the PIs, and that there are several cohort studies, including the DAD, that have suggested that select PIs, such as lopinavir, ritonavir, may also be a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. Now, the data is not as strong, at least within the cohort studies. The actual relative risk isn't as great, but it is there. One of the limitations we have in how to deal with that data is that we've not seen data yet telling us that the alternatives, such as atazanavir or darunavir or ritonavir, are better, just because they simply have not been able to do those analyses as carefully with those drugs as they've had with lopinavir or ritonavir. So we've got a lot of things we're dealing with and we're struggling with. I continue to say the best thing we can do in our practice and with our patients is make sure we have a careful distinction between the things that we really know and what we think, so that we can be clear with our patients and be consistent in making our recommendations based on the various concerns that are unique to the individual. I'm sure more data will be coming from the existing cohorts and new cohorts over the coming years that will hopefully provide some additional clarity.
Yeah, it might be worth mentioning here pregnancy. And we've got rather limited choices in pregnancy. Current recommendations are usually to use AZT, 3TC, and boosted lopinavir, which is really not the best tolerated regimen these days. Women are already prone to nausea and other symptoms of pregnancy. Then we really do, I think, fairly urgently need approval of some newer and perhaps better tolerated regimens for women who are pregnant. I think that's coming, but currently that is the preferred choice. People with a history of mental health disorders might not be good candidates for efavirenz-based regimens based on the CNS side effects of efavirenz, particularly in the first 4 weeks. There's not actually a lot of hard data to say that you can't treat people with psychiatric disease with efavirenz. You can, but nevertheless, it's a cautionary issue, and I think many people, particularly with patients with high levels of anxiety, prefer to use other regimens. Then I think we've also mentioned patients who you have to treat right away. For instance, patients who present very late or present with an opportunistic infection such as pneumocystis, where the data from 5164 clearly indicates that starting treatment concurrently with the treatment for this OI is preferred. And those patients, you haven't had time to really get to know them and work out issues around such as disclosure or issues around their likelihood to adhere or not to adhere to a regimen. Those patients often get started on boosted PIs simply because of the higher barrier to resistance.
I think that is another factor I'm not sure we've mentioned yet, and that is the role of baseline drug resistance testing, which has been the standard of care now for some time. There is a frequency that ranges from 5 to 25 or 30%, depending on the community, of transmitted drug-resistant virus, and ideally that information should be available and incorporated into the thinking behind which regimen to start. Or if you don't have that data available, such as the situation Trevor was talking about, where you may want to start someone on treatment acutely along with an opportunistic infection such as pneumocystis, you may choose drugs in which the likelihood of transmitted resistance is lower, such as protease inhibitors versus NNRTIs, until drug resistance testing information becomes available. Regardless of what we do, and I've mentioned this before and I think it's important to keep in mind, this is not a one-step process, and often we do and can make adjustments, but we need to do it carefully, and patients need to be aware that all decisions about stopping therapy and changing therapy should be made after careful discussion with their provider.
I know many providers are going off the guidelines and putting together novel regimens for treatment-naive patients. Do you think it's a good idea or a bad one? Dr. Hawkins?
I think the short answer is that, in general, I think it's a bad one. There may be good reasons to choose novel regimens. For instance, if you really don't want to give someone tenofovir because of pre-existing renal disease, patients also have high risk factors for cardiovascular disease, and you decide you want to do a nucleoside-sparing regimen, I think that's legitimate. But to do it willy-nilly, in other words, to start using off-label regimens that without a clear indication or a need for them, I think not very responsible, because the regimens that we have now are generally very well tolerated and have been shown to be highly effective. And I think to start experimenting with regimens at this stage of the game is generally not a very good idea.
Yeah, I completely agree. And there are some historical disasters that have happened that nobody would have predicted. And perhaps the best example, of course, is the triple nuke regimen that included tenofovir, 3TC, and abacavir, which resulted in extraordinary high levels, not just of virologic failure, but of essentially pan-nucleoside resistance amongst those who experienced failure. And while people might say, well, but that was triple nukes and we wouldn't do that, but at the time, there was no reason to believe that triple nuke regimen would perform as poorly as it did. I think that's a legitimate concern anytime you use a novel regimen that hasn't been thoroughly investigated in a clinical trial. And I completely agree with Trevor. If you get backed into a corner, sometimes you need to do what's best for your particular patient. But it should only be done in the setting where you've been backed into a corner, where all efforts have been made to work with the patient to start on a tried-and-true, well-tested regimen. Until that's happened, I think that we really should avoid these novel combinations for first-line therapy when patients have so much at stake and are going to have such a long future with therapy.
What do you think about strategies like induction maintenance? Is that still popular?
Well, I think induction maintenance in the past, the results weren't very good because partly the maintenance regimens were not very effective. But I think it is a potential strategy in patients who develop a toxicity to part of the drug regimen. A thing that I always used to do that I don't do anymore is the most common resistance pattern we see now is K103N and 184. It's rare now to see multiple drug-resistant patients, although they do occur. In those patients, I would treat with a boosted PI. Usually, this is after an A-triple failure, an efavirenz failure. I would treat with tenofovir, keep in the cytosine analog, the FTC, and in a fixed-dose combination, and add a thymidine analog until the patient was undetectable, and then drop the thymidine analog because of long-term toxicity issues. In general, these days, I don't do that. I would treat that particular failure with just essentially the boosted PI and tenofovir FTC. I think there's not a lot of data. In fact, there's really no randomized data on how to treat that particular set of mutations, but induction maintenance might be a strategy still for patients who fail an efavirenz-based regimen with a very high viral load, for instance.
So what Trevor is talking about, I think, is the group of patients who fail a first-line regimen with NNRTI, where they're going to then get a boosted PI, and then the question is, how many other drugs do you need to use with it? And,
yeah.
And I agree. I think the amount of experience that we have in doing this now with simply two nukes, like tenofovir FTC, with the boosted PI, suggests that for most patients that is sufficient to fully suppress virus. Certainly the experience in small randomized control trials, even with boosted PIs alone in PI-naive patients, would suggest that these drugs are going to contribute a lot of activity and that they may not need two other fully active drugs to completely suppress the virus. And there was recently a retrospective review of data from Canada where they were actually able to show, again, in a retrospective review, that those who received just the two nukes like you proposed with the boosted PI actually did as well as those who received additional drugs along with two nukes and a boosted PI. So I agree. But I think where maintenance has been best tested with the most promising results has probably been with boosted PIs, where there have been now numerous studies taking patients who start on a triple drug regimen that includes a boosted PI and then drop the nukes. But the one constant in these studies seems to be, again, not in every single one of them, is that while the boosted PI alone in this type of strategy seems to be very effective with relatively low risk of selecting for PI resistance, there tends to be more people with low-level viremia. It leaves us wondering what we need to worry about in those people as far as selecting for resistance over long periods of follow-up and whether there's enough data to suggest that that's a viable strategy, considering the limited concerns of current nucleoside combinations, which come as one pill once a day. Certainly it's lower cost, and for select patients where there are unique toxicities that may push us away from nucleosides, it may still be an option. But I'm not sure that the data is sufficient to justify this as a routine strategy in somebody where you don't have a really compelling reason to stop nucleosides in that setting.
Right, and also would add it, the ARIES study, which showed that maintenance with unboosted atazanavir after patients had suppressed on a boosted atazanavir regimen seemed to work quite well, and particularly that would be a reasonable strategy for patients who are having a tough time with low-dose ritonavir.
I agree. I think that was also a very important study and does provide an option for people who are having difficulties with ritonavir, which is one of the situations, not that common, but it is a situation that occurs. It's useful to have that kind of data to help us make decisions.
To conclude, Dr. Dar, is it a good time or a bad time to be selecting therapy for someone with HIV?
This is an extraordinary time, and I always tell people when I meet them, who are newly diagnosed, starting therapy for the first time, that while it's unfortunate that they're having to deal with HIV as a part of their life, the timing couldn't be better. We do have a lot of data, we have a lot of options, and I think there's every reason to believe that the overwhelming majority of people we start therapy on for the first time will ultimately end up, whether it's the first or second regimen, I can't guarantee them, but will ultimately end up on a regimen that will be extremely easy for them to take, very, very well tolerated, and will probably suppress their virus and control their disease for many, many years, if not a lifetime.
I am similarly optimistic with my patients and supportive of that. And I think we have so many efficacious regimens, as I said before. I think tolerability becomes such a driving issue, both short-term tolerability and long-term issues. I think the outlook for people who get infected, obviously, is so much better than it was in the past. And I think we have every reason to believe it will continue to improve.
Well, we've run out of time. Thank you so much, Dr. Hawkins and Dr. Dar, for sharing your knowledge and insights. That's it for the first topic of the BodyPro.com's new series, HIV Management Today. Stay tuned for other discussions in this series. Thanks again for listening.
This has been a news report from thebodypro.com. The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us at news@thebodypro.com.